You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what does a French horn sound like when you distort it or mix it with a synthesizer? The director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space joins the show to share some of the new sounds he's come up with. Now, U.S. Olympic track and field champion Tori Bowie died tragically last month at the age of 32. Earlier this week, the autopsy report revealed that she died from pregnancy complications. The medical examiner in her case determined that Bowie may have suffered from eclampsia, a disorder related to high blood pressure during pregnancy. The gold medalist was 8 months pregnant and was otherwise in good health. Her unexpected death served as a stark reminder of the maternal health risks involved in pregnancy and the disproportionate effects on Black women in particular. We're learning more about those health risks and disparities in pregnancy, along with efforts to solve them. Tiffany Green is an assistant professor in the departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. I talked to her earlier today. Now, let's start by talking about this tragic story about Tori Bowie. Can you talk about eclampsia? And this is more common pre-eclampsia. What are those for people who aren't familiar?
So for those who aren't familiar, there are certain conditions in pregnancy, especially those related to high blood pressure, that can be very dangerous for the birthing parent or the baby. Preeclampsia and eclampsia often happen before labor and delivery, but they could actually happen after those points as well.
What are some of the risks and signals that this may be coming, preeclampsia and then eclampsia?
A big one is elevated blood pressure, which is one of the reasons why clinicians, I'm not a clinician, but one of the reasons why they follow pregnant people so closely in terms of blood pressure is making sure that you don't have those conditions, because they can be fatal, as we saw here, and they can result in all kinds of maternal morbidity and mortality. It can also cause organ failure, all kinds of things that are just incredibly dangerous, which is why clinicians stay on top of it so heavily. Since some of the symptoms in addition to high blood pressure are going to be things like swelling of the extremities, like your hands and your feet.
Now, we know that the United States has a higher incidence of maternal mortality compared to other countries, and you and I have talked in the past. That's not evenly distributed, very big racial disparities. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, you know, and I when I thought about coming here, I wish I had easy answers. I wish I could give your listeners an easy answer as to why that's the case. But as I've shared with you before, we've identified this disparity in 1917, over 100 years ago, and even before that. And so these disparities continue to persist. But one reason, of course, is that, you know, that people at structural disadvantages, like racially marginalized groups and other groups, come into pregnancy without having the same access to healthcare prior to getting pregnant. You know, they experience other stressors. There are so many things that determine why Black birthing people and pregnant people come into pregnancy with more challenges relative to other groups.
Yeah, when we hear a story like the tragic one about Tori Bowie, I think we think about, okay, what could we have done in the days before this, or maybe in the months? As you and I have talked about in the past, we might be needing to start years before. Can you talk about some of the structural things out there that might be years in the making before that pregnancy even happens that raises that risk?
Well, there are so many factors in that matrix. One of them is what we talked about before, is where you live, where you work, where you play. And we know that that factors such as segregation, right, are linked to poor health outcomes among people, including Black people, such as high blood pressure, right? So those are things that matter. Making sure that you and to be honest with you, I don't think that healthcare is the only answer or even the hugest answer. But clearly, with things like preeclampsia and eclampsia, monitoring by a healthcare provider is also super important to have. So you know, my view, as I've always been pretty transparent about, is really thinking about the very structure of our society and how it predisposes people to be sick and to come into pregnancy with more challenges relative to others. And I want to be clear that this is not a story about individual level behaviors or individual level failings. It's about the way that we structured our society in a way that continues to promote inequality.
Talking to Tiffany Green, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison, looking at maternal health risks, eclampsia, preeclampsia, the long-term things that that can put people at higher risk. Let's take it to the pregnancy now. And we've heard account after account in recent years. And before that, Tiffany, black moms not being listened to by healthcare providers, poor communication sometimes from providers. What kind of things can we do to improve that communication and the care at that stage?
You know, that's always a challenging question for me to answer, Rob, because I think we do have evidence that that discrimination and racism in an aggregate sense, these environments are contributing to worse outcomes. But I don't think we have a really good handle on the links between provider beliefs and behavior and actual treatment. And that is a really tricky and difficult thing for me to express, because I want to be clear. It's not that I'm minimizing the role of discrimination in these kinds of behaviors. It's that we don't really have as good a handle as I would like us to have on those outcomes. I think what we can do is really do more to make sure that we are having patient-centered medical treatment, that we are listening to pregnant people, that we're making sure that they have the resources that we need. One example, full disclosure, I'm involved in the evaluation. I think I shared this before with you, is the ConnectRx program in Dane County. And that is a program that supports Black pregnant people with certain risk factors, including being unhoused, maybe experiencing food insecurity, stressors, and it connects them with community-based organizations to make sure that they are getting their social needs met. And in addition, it assigns them a doula if they would like one. And that doula accompanies them at labor and delivery if they would like, and also supports them postpartum. And I want to say it's not responsible to speculate about what happened in Tory's case, mm-hmm. but it's really clear that we are a society that often leaves pregnant people and birthing people by the wayside in terms of social supports. And one of the key things that matters in terms of social supports are people that can not just help you take care of the baby, but people can watch you for symptoms like postpartum eclampsia, right? Those things matter in terms of watching for symptoms of severe maternal morbidity that can turn into something worse.
When you look at Wisconsin in particular, what do you see when it comes to these disparities we're talking about and ways to try to bridge them here?
Yeah, so we do certainly experience disparities in pregnancy-related morbidity in general. Those disparities are lower in absolute terms relative to national averages. However, the disparities are wider. Actually, the group that has the highest rates of pregnancy-related morbidity are Indigenous populations in Wisconsin, followed very closely by Black birthing populations, right? So this is something that's really important to understand. And the same is true for pregnancy mortality, right? We have lower levels of pregnancy-related mortality, but the disparities, Black-white disparities, are wider, right? And so those are some things to think about. So what can we do about it is the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. One is realize that this is a complicated thing that we want to be able to say, let's fix it at the hospital level. Let's fix medical care providers. And while I want to be clear that we do need to fix medical systems, that's not where the majority of our deaths are coming from. A lot of what we don't talk about is a lot of pregnancy-related deaths in Wisconsin are coming as a result of things like overdoses, right? They're coming from things like other cardiovascular conditions, right? These are things that we need to fix in terms of our policies, right? This is not just an individual level behavior thing. It is a policy decision that we have made, and we need to address those things quickly.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yes, no problem. Great to be here.
That was Tiffany Green, assistant professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about maternal health and pregnancy complications after the recent tragic death of Olympic track and field champion Tori Bowie. Coming up, a UW-Madison music professor joins the show to tell us what electroacoustic music is and to tell us about how he and students experiment with instruments and sound. That's coming up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, what does a French horn sound like in your head? Maybe it's something like this. But what if you changed how it sounds with a distortion pedal, like you might see used with a guitar? That sound is from a collection of recordings called Air Names. It was made by our next guest with the help of the Electroacoustic Research Space, or EARS for short, at UW-Madison School of Music. It's a studio that lets musicians experiment with, you know, your normal acoustic instruments, a French horn or a flute, say, and electronic instruments like synthesizers to come up with really different, maybe even completely new kinds of sounds and music. Dan Grabois is an assistant professor of horn and the director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space. I talked to him last year. Paint us, please, a picture of this lab.
This lab is a former classroom that has been repurposed. So it's in the humanities building, but it doesn't have the aura of the humanities building. It's updated a little bit, and it is chock full of electronic instruments.
What was the inspiration for you to have not just these electronic instruments, but this interface between traditional acoustic instruments and all this electronic gear?
Well, for me, that started when I got to UW. I had before been the chair of contemporary performance at the Manhattan School of Music, and I hired a colleague to come and teach electronic music to my students, and they were making incredible sounds, and I thought, wow, I could change the sound of the horn and play a much bigger variety of music. So when I got here, I was provided with some research funds, and I started buying pedals and microphones and that sort of thing. And I made the Air Names recording that you just played a little bit of, which was mostly featuring the horn in various kinds of distortion and with effects on it. From there, everything derived out of an email that I received one summer, and it said, we are offering a round of UW 2020 large equipment grants. And the idea behind this grant was really, hey, chemistry department needs an electron microscope, and so does biochemistry. So let's provide one electron microscope and have them share. And I thought, well, I could put together a ton of pieces of electronic music equipment and call that large equipment. And so I put in an application. I got everything I asked for. So thank you, Worf.
Now let's check out another clip, another taste of the music. This is from your latest project, released coming out in October, I think, called Fire Names. I think I'm hearing a fairly unprocessed French horn out front there. What's going on behind it, though?
So this really is electroacoustic music. The French horn's completely unprocessed, except that it's being recorded, obviously, mm-hmm. So there's some amount of mixing going on. But yes, so what I did is I wrote a tape track. Of course, there's no tape involved anymore. Everything is digitally recorded. But I used the instruments in EARS to create this 44-minute-long tape track, and then I wrote a horn part to go on top of it. And so when I was recording the horn part, which I did in my basement with EARS microphones, I didn't have to distort the horn at all. I wanted it to be very pure, and I played over that tape track.
Now, I'm kind of a music nerd. As I looked at the list of your electronic equipment, it includes things like old Moog synthesizers, a theremin, I think, and then some things I've never heard of, including a Continuum fingerboard.
Yeah, that's actually if I had to choose a favorite child, it would be the Continuum fingerboard. It's an instrument that's been in production for something like 15 or 20 years, but it changes every few years and is updated. It was invented by a someone named Lippold Hocken, who teaches engineering at the University of Illinois. And the reason it's called a continuum is it has a keyboard, but the keyboard is made of squishy foam with the notes more painted on the foam than actual separate notes. So you can drag your finger along the keyboard and make it go continuously, hence continuum fingerboard. And it's a very expressive instrument.
So that makes me like a fretless bass, where usually you'd have distinct notes there, but without the frets, you can move up and down. Same thing. I never would have thought it possible for a keyboard.
Yeah, it's an incredible invention. And it responds also in several other directions. So that side-to-side or X-axis is operating with the instrument, but there's also a Y axis. So the keyboard has a certain thickness, and it's a synthesizer. So for some of the sounds, as you move your finger further away from you or more towards you, the sound will transform. And then the Z axis, how hard you push down, generally controls how loud or soft you play, but it can be programmed to control anything you want.
Talking to Dan Graboy from UW-Madison, director of the Electroacoustic Research Space. We're checking out some of their music, and I want to give a listen to, I think you're featuring your favorite kid, as you said, the Continuum Fingerboard, in this excerpt from Fire Names. Here's a listen. I think I'm hearing what is the continuum fingerboard with those where you can, yep.
That bass line is continuum fingerboard, but the thing that goes da-di-tom-ba-ba-di is also continuum fingerboard with a different sound. This is all recorded multi-tracked, so you record one thing and then you put something else on top and you have infinite tracks that you can use.
Okay, one more taste of that, I think. A later part here in Fire Names. Tell us a little more about what we're hearing there.
Right. So everything you heard there is continuum, and a big, big, juicy, fat sound on the bottom. And then on top, this sort of Asian-sounding instrument, which is really interesting. It uses that Z-axis, how hard you push against it. The harder you push against it, the more it goes boing and bends up. So if you just tap it, it goes ding, 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 ding. And as you push harder, boing, boing, boing. So it makes a really kind of an interesting ornamented sound.
Okay, so this is in effect a music laboratory. What kind of things do music students get in and experiment, slash play with in there?
So I have a band that's a student ensemble. It's actually a class. And the band is called $2 Broom. And if anybody gets the reference, they win the prize for the day. But we improvise using the instruments. So students learn how to play the instruments, which is usually pretty easy. Most of the instruments have a very tactile interface. And in fact, for, say, a cellist or a violinist that has become very, very engrossed in their technique on their instrument, putting their hands in front of the theremin and moving them around and see what happens is a really revelatory experience. It's no longer about just how you make that vibrato with your left hand and how you draw the bow, but just pure experimentation. So we go on stage with this band at the end of each semester and play for about an hour with nothing written down and nothing planned.
Okay, but suppose somebody comes there with a cello or a French horn or whatever. They've devoted their life to this instrument in a lot of ways, and they're playing through some of these processors and synthesizers and things like that. What is their reaction? Is it, this is cool, or, wait, this isn't what my instrument is supposed to sound like?
Usually their reaction is something that I can't even quote on the radio.
They're generally in a bad way.
In a good way.
Okay.
They're usually so excited about what their instrument will sound like, and we do that. For instance, we had a cellist play on our last concert, and he did some cello playing as well as playing other of the ear's instruments, and he was running through effects. And what's so interesting is that you find that your playing changes based on what you're hearing, which is not that surprising, but it really draws that idea into focus, especially as you think of each musician as kind of a composer when you're improvising. So the ideas that are generated are inspired by the sound that's coming into your ears.
Briefly, as we wrap up, live gigs for $2 Broom or any other projects coming out where we could see this in action?
Yes, but you'll have to stay tuned because we set our concerts kind of in the middle of the semester, we figure out a time when everyone's free and when we'll be ready. But they may be billed as the Electroacoustic Improv Ensemble or $2 Broom. I'm not sure how our
What's the real name?
Yeah. The real name, as far as I'm concerned, is $2 Broom.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dan Graboy. He's an assistant professor of horn and director of the Electroacoustic Research Space, or EARS, at UW-Madison. I talked with him last year about his work at EARS and to share some of the experimental music he's made there. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the Human Rights Campaign says there's a state of emergency for LGBTQ Americans. Find out why and look at the long story of progress and pushback. And it's mosquito and tick season in Wisconsin. A state expert joins the show for a look at the season so far and how to protect ourselves from diseases that can be carried by ticks and mosquitoes. You can share a condition report from your own backyard or your latest hike. What are you seeing out there? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can also share your questions about mosquitoes and ticks along the way. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk about President Biden's plan to name a point person at the Education Department to address the huge increase in school book bans over the last few years. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday, we sift through the thousands of skillets on the market to decide which one's the right one for you. First, President Biden announced last week that he would name a point person in the Education Department to address the rise in school book bans. In 2022, attempted book bans at schools and public libraries reached an all-time high since the American Library Association started recording book bans 20 years ago. That continues the upward recent trend. According to an analysis by the group PEN America, about 40% of the banned books included LGBTQ characters and themes, about 40% featured characters of color. A handful of states have passed laws making it easier to challenge books, while Illinois recently passed a bill limiting book removals. Want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have books been challenged in your school district, your local library? Have you led a challenge or asked for something to be reshelved elsewhere? What are your thoughts on schools keeping certain books off the shelves? Where should lines be drawn? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Louise Robbins is an emeritus professor of library and information studies at UW-Madison and the author of The Dismissal of Miss Ruth Brown, Civil Rights, Censorship, and the American Library. Louise, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Before we get into this new point person in the education department, I just want to get your thoughts as someone who's observed these issues and how they've played out over time. What are your thoughts on this last couple of years where we've seen this big increase in challenges and removals of books?
Well, it's very distressing. We've had challenges to books as long as there have been libraries, I suppose, but the intellectual freedom position of librarianship has evolved in an effort to make it possible for people to get a variety of opinions on different subjects to allow people to learn as much as they can. So having more censorship, having more book bans makes it harder for people to gain new perspectives or even to support their own perspectives. Historically, things have moved much more slowly because people have communicated by letter or by telephone, not by internet. So censorship hasn't gained steam the way it has in the last couple of years when we've been so extremely polarized.
Part of the goal of this new position in the education department would be to explain to schools in particular that removing books could infringe on students' federal civil rights. What are your thoughts on the possibilities of a role like this in the federal government?
Well, it'll be a first, but there have been supports for librarians in the past. But in this case, I think the having the weight of the Department of Education, of the federal government, to inform people is very helpful, because it gives heft and gives authority to that understanding.
In a school in particular, parents might have a concern that they don't want sexual material, for example, or graphic descriptions of sexual material in a school. Do we have a good process for deciding, hey, this book might be okay at a high school, but isn't okay at an elementary school, for example?
There are processes for determining what should go into libraries. Librarians have a very elaborate process of reading reviews, reading the books, listening to others, making choices based on awards, reviews, and so on, and then putting them in the area they think is most helpful to students. I think there's also a process for removing books, if that's, or challenging them. The challenger should have read the book in its entirety to be able to identify what portions of it are offensive to that person, to make an argument for or against the book, and then to submit that to the librarian, who normally has a committee set up to help review such things, so that it can go through a process. Of course, when one person finds offensive may not be offensive to someone else. So imposing the will of one individual on an entire school library would not be a very good idea.
Might the answer to a particular book being challenged look different from one community to another community? Does that process say, our town here doesn't think this is appropriate for kids of this age? Another community might come up with something different. And I don't know, maybe that's okay.
It could be. I think that the issue is, okay, we don't have very many people of color in this community, so we shouldn't have any books about people of color. Well, in the great wide world, you're going to run into people of color. You need to know something about other people, whether you have them in your community at this moment or not. So I think it's dangerous to say, well, we're a very small kind of insular community, so we don't want to know about the world outside of us. I think that it would be best, of course, if people could be exposed to a wide variety of viewpoints. But yes, librarians try to take into consideration their communities and what the community wants and needs.
We're talking to Louise Robbins, Emeritus Professor of Library and Information Studies at UW-Madison, looking at book bans, book challenges, and removals in schools and libraries. The White House says they're going to have a new point person in the Education Department to work on that issue. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on the issue, maybe your experiences in your own community. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I was just thinking about the Scopes monkey trial that had something to do with teaching about evolution in high school. Mm-hmm. And it's a religious thing. And for public schools, there should be a separation of church and state. Parochial schools, yeah, if they want to ban things, well, it's up to them. But as far as the religion, well, you need to be careful whose religion you want to ban, because it seems like people want to ban everybody else's except theirs.
Dennis, thanks for the call, Louise. Religious basis for challenging books, how does that play out in practice?
Well, I think I agree with Dennis. I think it's very dangerous to say, my religion's okay, but yours isn't. And I think this is going to have ramifications across the board as we more and more use federal funds or local funds to fund parochial or private schools. There should be some strings attached to that funding to make sure that people whose religion is not identical to that of the sponsor have some rights in terms of collections as well. So I would, I think Dennis is right. We need to be careful whose religion, or whether we're going to put restrictions on religious materials.
Thanks for that call, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. Louise, as I mentioned at the outset, about 40% of the books banned, this is according to Pan America, from 2021 to 2022, featured LGBTQ plus themes and or characters. Now, there might be parents who make these challenges who say, you know what, I don't want my kid exposed to what I consider, the parent might say, a lifestyle I don't approve of that doesn't match my religious principles. How would you hope schools and libraries deal with a complaint from that perspective?
I think that there is a system that already in place where libraries can handle that. A parent can make clear to the librarian on some kind of form, if it needs to be formal, and it probably does, that my child is not to check out books about X, Y, and Z. And the librarian can easily enough steer that child away from those books without limiting other children to selecting books without limiting other children. So I think that the issue is, when you make a complaint, you need to say, I don't want my child doing this, but you don't necessarily have the right to tell another parent what his or her child can do. I think it's very certainly clear that you can limit what your own child does.
Let's go back to our callers now. Ryan is with us in Glendale. Ryan, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would describe myself as very pro First Amendment, but I do worry about if we are going to prohibit or limit the authority of librarians in one area, that means that we're compelling the authority of librarians in other areas. And it seems like it could very easily lead to compelled speech, especially if there's a government entity in charge, like this proposed official at the Department of Education, to say that you must carry these books or you must promote these ideas.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Louise, go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what Ryan means. Ryan, when you say compelled speech, you mean that people are going to be forced to collect certain materials?
Well, what I mean is, if you say that the community has a very limited say in what's available, then it seems to me that means that the government is then saying this material must be available whether the community wants it or not. And that, to me, seems to be a form of compelled speech.
Well, I think that is a potential danger. I don't foresee it happening, because I think so far as I've been able to understand thus far, the position of the government is we're going to tell them what the law says, what the law has said so far about the rights of students to access library materials. We're not going to tell you that you have to stock X, Y, and Z books in your library, but to enable librarians to have a backup if they need some defense. As an example, in the past, one of the strangest stories that I've come across is that in 1958, I think it was, a children's book, Rabbit's Wedding, which you may have heard of, has a picture on the cover of a black rabbit and a white rabbit. A librarian, the state librarian in Alabama, almost lost her job because some legislators said that this was promoting interracial marriage. I doubt Garth Williams, the illustrator, ever thought about that when he did his book. But these kinds of, a person like this librarian needed to know that she had the right to fight for that book to be on the shelves. So it's just giving the librarian some support and backup, and letting them know what the law actually is and what the best practice in the profession is. There are lots of people out there who have little libraries that don't have much support in terms of professional guidance. And this would be useful to those people if they need it.
Ryan, thanks for calling in. We're talking about school and library book bans with Louise Robbins, Emeritus Professor of Library and Information Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When do you think a book should be removed from a library or a school library? If ever, have you participated on either part of a book challenge at a library? And what are your thoughts on this big jump in the number of books being challenged or removed from libraries? Changes in state laws in both directions, making it easier or harder to remove books? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about President Biden's appointment of a book ban response coordinator at the U.S. Education Department. Louise Robbins is with us, Emeritus Professor of Library and Information Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. There's been a big jump over the last couple of years in the number of books, the number of titles being challenged at school libraries and other libraries, and book removals as well. Some states making it easier to take books off the shelves. Some, like Illinois, passing laws to make it more difficult. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. Allie is with us in New Richmond. Allie, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Allie?
So I am curious. Access to books and freedom of information, is that a freedom of speech? And then I'm also curious, if the books are on the shelves and you don't like it, just don't read it. And we're in an age of you can get your hands on any books that you want. So even if they're banned, people will have access to them somewhere.
Allie, thanks for the call. Louise, Allie, first of all, asking, you know, how much does the First Amendment play into these issues?
The First Amendment plays into these issues a great deal. Freedom of speech also implies a freedom to receive speech. If there's nobody to listen, there's not much point of speaking. So this is the two sides of the same coin. Freedom of speech and freedom of the press kind of go hand in hand. Freedom to receive information is crucial. And I think that Allie has a point that things do get, the word does get out. If a book is banned, someone, in some cases, it makes the book even more attractive. In fact, historically, the label banned in Boston was sought after by some authors in the 20th century and the late 19th century, but especially the early 20th century, because they felt that, and they did, it did increase the book sales tremendously. So if a book is controversial these days, chances are it will be discovered and read by young people. In fact, I was talking with friends of my age the other day, and everyone could remember passing around an old copy of Peyton Place. Because with the parts underlined, we didn't read the whole book. We just were looking for the naughty parts, right? And I think a lot of kids do that. It would be much better for them to have the opportunity to read a book under the guidance of a librarian or a teacher or a parent than to be passing books around like that.
Thanks for the call, Allie. That point from Allie about access, though, I've seen it kind of flipped around on the other side. Well, okay, if we've taken it off the shelf in the school library or the library, no problem. If a parent really wants to have this book for their kid, they can find it probably online. They can order it. So the harm of removing it isn't so great. What do you think of that, Louise?
Well, I think that the harm varies. Libraries are especially designed to serve everyone. So those people who don't have access to large resources to purchase things are much more likely to gain access to information, to good reading, to the internet, to online resources through a public library. If you go into the library most days, you can find people using the computer for job applications or to do research on what skills they need to get a particular job. There are all kinds of things that libraries are used for. They are used to develop people's reading skills and their information literacy skills, to create community. Many, many, many roles that the library has these days. So, and books, access to books is one big important one, but in some ways is only one part of the role of libraries, but it's most important for those who don't have inexhaustible resources to order online or to search, spend all the time looking in used bookstores.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jerry is with us in La Crosse. Jerry, hi.
Yeah, hi. I keep thinking that this subject is very interesting and very important, that book banning and or compulsion, as one listener talked about, are very important, and it's related to other issues. The other issue I want to mention is health teachers. We have books in the school library. We also have health teachers. And these teachers are walking a very careful tightrope. They have to be very careful about what they say. They have to be very careful about how they react to certain students' comments. They are, really worried.
I gotcha. Jerry, thanks for the call. Louise, I know you mostly focus on the library side of thing. Do you share Jerry's concern about, a chilling effect on what teachers can say if they're teaching health or American politics or you name it?
I absolutely do, and health is an important one. I know when I first began my library career, the person that I worked under hid the only book on human development in the library when there were so many kids who really needed that book. They'd had no idea what was going on in their own bodies, and they needed it. But I wasn't in charge, so I had to fight for that one. But I agree that it's very concerning that people have to be so careful, and they have to be careful about things they shouldn't have to be careful about. I mean, we should be able to talk about our history. We should be able to talk about people's identities. We should be able to talk about health and so on. So I'm very concerned that we are completely altering how people learn in a negative way.
Thanks for that call. And Louise, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Louise Robbins, Emeritus Professor of Library and Information Studies at UW-Madison and author of the book The Dismissal of Miss Ruth Brown, Civil Rights, Censorship, and the American Library. She joined us to talk about President Biden's plan to name a point person in the Education Department to address the rise in book bans in school libraries and other libraries over the last couple of years. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll find out how to pick the perfect skillet for our cooking needs. You can get things started right now. Do you have a skillet that, you'll guard it with your life, something that you've really relied on in the kitchen? Or do you have a question? If you're about to go shopping, email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.